just awareness won't solve the problem. Think of healthy eating or exercising. Just being aware that we shouldn't eat more than, you know, 2,000 calories or 1,500 calories, depending on people's size, a day doesn't necessarily mean that we won't have ice cream tonight. And that's a bit the same problem, that this intention-action gap is real for human beings and that it's not always easy for us to live up to our virtuous intentions.
Hello and welcome to the Harvard Kennedy School Policycast. I'm your host, Togo Moyo. Today, I'm very pleased to welcome Iris Barnett, who is the co-director of the Women and Public Policy Program here at the Kennedy School. She's also our academic dean. Iris is a behavioral economist and a leading researcher into gender bias, and she's been giving out some tough advice recently to governments and to big corporations. Stop wasting your money on traditional diversity training programs because they don't work. It turns out that no matter how enlightened we think we are, the research shows that, regardless of race and gender, we are all pretty much affected by unconscious bias. However, there's some good news too. Using behavioral design, organizations can create better processes that help prevent us imperfect humans from making biased decisions. Welcome to Policycast. In your work, you talk a lot about unconscious bias being one of the drivers or the reasons that we don't have as many women in leadership positions as we'd want. Let's just start at the very beginning. What is unconscious bias and how is it affecting women?
Well, first of all, thanks very much for having me. It's a great pleasure to talk a bit more about our work on how we can de-bias, how we live, how we learn, and how we work. So unconscious bias is very much part of human mindsets. And that's, you know, in many ways, good and bad news, in that the good news is that this is about all of us. Mm-hmm. And the bad news is that it is about all of us.
Okay.
But I'm saying that in the sense that the unconscious bias is shared by people. This is not about pointing fingers mm-hmm. at particular people.
It's not exclusive to one group.
No, not at all. Okay. Not at all. And it has to do with these images that we have of certain individuals. Do they fit the category that I have in mind when I want to hire a conductor or when I want to hire an assistant or when I want to hire a physician? Mm-hmm. So seeing very much is believing. And if we don't see people kind of fitting into certain categories, we don't imagine that this is right for them.
So let's make it more concrete. So when we talk about women in the workplace, give me an example of what the research or the evidence shows in terms of unconscious bias and how it affects women.
Yeah. So in our universities, we now use a very simple exercise to help our students understand what unconscious bias is in a matter of minutes, really. Mm-hmm. We do a case study with them about Heidi Roizen. Heidi Roizen is a venture capitalist. She's mm-hmm. a real person.
Real person.
Venture capitalist in Silicon Valley. And this is a case study that most of our listeners would have seen before that describes what she did, how mm-hmm. she built her enterprises, how she networked in the Valley, etc. Mm-hmm. And then a few colleagues of ours took this case study, which was written by Kathleen McGinn of the Harvard Business School originally, and replaced Heidi's name with Howard.
Okay.
And now we give half of our students the case study with the protagonist being called Heidi, mm-hmm. and the other half with the protagonist being called Howard. Mm-hmm. And students don't just prepare the case, but also evaluate how well Heidi and Howard did. Mm-hmm. And students agree that both Heidi and Howard did a great job, in mm-hmm. fact.
Because they're the same person.
They're the same person, right? It's exactly right. There's nothing different, really, other than their names.
Yeah.
But men and women, and that's actually important to know, men and women agree that Heidi is just not quite as likable as Howard. We're less likely to want to hire her or want to work with her.
Well, and this is based on the same information.
That's based on the exact same information. And the reason is that Heidi doesn't quite conform with our stereotypes of what the typical venture capitalist looks like,
okay.
but also with our stereotypes of what a good woman does.
That is so interesting. And this was both men and women, because you'd expect that maybe men would say that, but women held the same view about what a woman, what a venture capitalist could be or what a good woman is.
Yes, exactly. So there are nuances. So there are some gender differences in terms of the sex or the gender of the observer, but they're much, much smaller than most people think. So most people, in fact, would think that men are more likely to associate things with men, women mm-hmm. are more likely or more lenient in judging other women, mm-hmm. but we don't actually find that.
So is it possible? I mean, that's quite something. So is it possible then to change a mindset? Because I'd imagine then you'd want to try and work on changing people's idea of what a venture capitalist is or, you know, what a good woman is. I mean, can you do that?
Yeah, sadly, it's really hard. So the first part of my research focused on research, not my own, on just evaluating the research out there on whether, in fact, diversity training is possible, whether okay. we can train out bias, so to speak, okay. mm-hmm. from our mindsets. And then, unfortunately, at the time when I wrote the book, my book, What Works, in 2016, I had not found one single study evaluating diversity training that works. Now, mm-hmm. you know, this could be two explanations. One is it really doesn't work, okay. and I'll give you some reasons why I think it might actually not work so well. Mm-hmm. But secondly, an important message here also is that we don't measure nearly enough. You know, most mm-hmm. organizations just do diversity training, so to speak, blindly, yeah. without ever evaluating their impact.
Is it possible that the diversity training that you looked at was just bad? I mean, with better diversity training might have results? I mean, is that...
That's possible. I mean, that is totally possible that somebody has come up with diversity training that wasn't evaluated, that somebody has discovered the secret sauce. But, you know, I'm a behavioral economist, and in behavioral science, we have been trying to, so to speak, fix mindsets, not just in terms of gender bias, but lots of other biases, cognitive biases. So we've been trying to fix mindsets for a very long time with relatively little success. And the problem is that we don't typically have our better selves, our superego, so to speak, sit on our shoulders and whisper into our ears whenever we are about to fall into one of those traps.
I find that quite scary, actually. And I know we're going to get to good news piece, but you always imagine that there's a possibility to change sort of someone's mindset and that, you know, you do enough of the right things that you could do it. But if you're starting from a premise that actually you can't, so where do we go from there?
So let me maybe offer some nuances. I'm not saying that we cannot at least open some hearts and minds by making people aware of some of these issues. And I think that's in many ways kind of the good news. I think the more complicated news is that just awareness won't solve the problem. And, you know, think of an example, a totally different example from a different domain, as in healthy eating or exercising. Just being aware that we shouldn't eat more than, you know, 2,000 calories or 1,500 calories, depending on people's size a day doesn't necessarily mean that we won't have ice cream tonight. And that's a bit the same problem, that this intention-action gap is real for human beings and that it's not always easy for us to live up to our virtuous intentions. So in that sense, there's nothing very different about gender bias compared to many other biases. It's just hard then to move beyond awareness. So we have to give people the tools to make those virtuous intentions a reality.
That's quite an idea. I mean, the estimates say, I think, about $8 billion is spent in the U.S. on diversity training. So that's quite a mind shift. What sort of things are you advising, you know, when you talk to corporates, NGOs, et cetera, about the money that they're spending on diversity training? What are the things that do work?
Yeah, so it's definitely very common. I mean, most organizations do have some sort of diversity training, partly because they're mandated to do so by law. And certainly there's huge variety in diversity training, you know, from literally checking the box as having a short half hour or 1 hour online training to longer types of interventions. But yes, so the big question is how, you know, how do we move beyond diversity training? What more can we do? And there I would very strongly argue that we have to de-bias our systems instead of trying to de-bias our mindsets.
Okay, so let's talk about that some more. What does that look like?
So maybe it's easiest if you just go, in fact, let me start with a concrete example and then maybe we can talk a bit about the workplace. But I want to take a bit of a detour and just give an example of how, you know, simple these interventions can be. So one of the very salient examples comes from orchestras. In the 70s, many of our bigger symphony orchestras in this country have introduced curtains and have had musicians audition behind a curtain.
Okay.
So these blind auditions have, in fact, increased the fraction of female musicians in our major orchestras dramatically. In the 70s, there were about 5% women playing music in our orchestras. Now it's close to 40%. And research by Claudia Golden and Cecilia Rice, and Claudia is a professor at the Harvard Econ Department, kind of have shown that the big part of that is, in fact, the curtain. And a number of organizations have adopted blind evaluation procedures. So, for example, the UK government is the first big country which is now experimenting with blind evaluations of civil servants. So that's one, you know, behavioral design that you might want to think about as an organization. It's not the only one, but I think makes this quite clear that one way to overcome unconscious bias is just to disable us, basically,
to be able to bring that into
difference,
it.
Right?
Right. And I guess you'd also, just exploring the idea of sort of blind evaluations in a workplace situation. So you'd be looking to take out anything that identifies the gender. And if you want, for instance, so maybe the name, you blind that, and you wouldn't require people, and I think people do anyway, the people to say what's gender they are.
Yes.
So that's basically taking those out, reducing it.
That's right. At a minimum, you want to take off the name. But if you want to be a bit more advanced, you might want to be very carefully go through the CV and also take off, you know, sororities and other types of identifiers. You know, if you want to push this a bit further, there are now interesting startups, exciting startups, including from a graduate of the Kennedy School. And in fact, Kate Glazebrook, her company is called Applied. It's headquartered in the UK. And they blind evaluators to the demographic characteristics of job applicants. They don't just take off the name from the CV, but they, in fact, remove the CV completely, arguing that empirically speaking, and they're right, empirically speaking, the best predictor of future performance or success in an organization is not the CV, but a work sample test. So imagine you could test, or imagine you want to hire a coder, right? So that's an easy job to imagine that you would actually ask that person to write some code.
Right.
And that's probably more predictive of that person's future success than their CV or anything else they have done in the past.
That's interesting. But I guess the a CV is initially the first filter that you use to get the shortlist. And I don't know if you have any more information about how they would even get to the shortlist, because you need to get the people in the room to test them. How do you decide who they are?
Yeah, so they actually have everyone who applies do this online test. So they don't filter. And an interesting result that they found, so they did exactly this procedure with a tech company, and the tech company found some interesting things that nobody really expected. So when they used the CVs beforehand, they thought that somebody to work in this tech firm had to have a degree in computer science or in engineering to even make the shortlist. But without them being able to filter down to this shortlist, they had all kinds of different people with all kinds of different backgrounds kind of do the test. And they ended up hiring more neuroscientists, interestingly enough, because they did brilliantly on the tests, but they would never have made it through the filter beforehand.
That is so interesting. So what about the idea as well that you've talked about in terms of attracting more women to apply for a position based on the language that you use when you're advertising a position? Can you just talk about that a little bit as well?
Yeah, no, you're totally right. I mean, all of this, of course, starts. I mean, we could go, or we should go probably, through the whole life, right, of talent management.
Yeah,
and
okay.
It starts with our advertising of jobs. And it turns out that language can also be biased or gendered in certain ways. So there are words, for example, warm or caring or supportive, that in our minds are associated with women. And then there are other words such as assertive and, sadly, still leadership, that are more likely to be associated with men. And there are now algorithms which can predict how much you either increase or decrease the likelihood that men or women will apply, depending on the language that you use. And they will, in fact, you know, you just send them your text, your job ad, or, you know, also your performance evaluation or your letter of recommendation, really, you know, anything that you write. And they will analyze the text and will give it back to you, kind of highlight it with the words that fall into these different gender categories, but also with some recommendations. Mm-hmm. And what you can do is either do away with these words completely, because you might say, I don't actually need supportive. It's not quite as important to the job description. That might be one conclusion that you draw. Or you might say, well, supportive is really important as I'm looking for a teacher, for example, as a caregiver. So I really care about warm and supportive people. But I'm going to counterbalance these gender stereotypically female names with gender stereotypical male names.
So let me just get my head around that, because you're saying that you would use language that would that is likely to attract more female applicants because you want them in the pipeline for the recruitment. So just starting off, you want to have women apply for the jobs and then you can do the rest. But at the same time, I guess what I'm wondering is, if you do recommend to have words that are associated more with women, are you not in some way entrenching the stereotype of what women are and creating a Heidi problem where people imagine women are in a certain way? Does that make sense?
So first of all, I want to clarify that this is not per se about women,
okay,
but this is about kind of gender adjectives,
right,
that in our minds are, uh-huh, associated with men or women respectively.
Uh-huh.
And if we use those names, this is just a descriptive statement that I'm making,
uh-huh,
a prescriptive statement,
okay,
just a descriptive statement,
uh-huh,
that you will be more likely to attract women,
uh-huh,
if you use gender stereotypical female names,
okay,
or gender stereotypical male names, you will attract more men. Now, my argument typically is to broaden the talent pool and have a relatively balanced set of gender stereotypically coded
language,
female,
right,
names,
uh-huh,
or male names.
Okay.
But I want to clarify, this is not about women per se. It's typically about the counter stereotypical individual that you want to attract. So, for example, let's assume you're looking for more male teachers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's probably pretty natural for people then to go for caring, warm,
which
supportive.
Might put the men off.
But then we exactly.
Ah, got
but
it.
Then we know fewer, mm-hmm, men will apply, not just because this is a gender job, which,
uh-huh,
of course we know, 85% uh-huh, of teachers. Of primary school teachers are women, so it's definitely a right observation. But if you, on top of that,
uh-huh,
add more gendered language that we associate with women, then even fewer men will apply.
So you're using it as a tool.
Yes,
to
exactly.
Okay, got it. Okay, so let's keep going. So you've done the recruitment. Hopefully you've got a nice mix, a nice balance of people that have applied. The next step is the interview.
Yeah.
How do you do that in a way that's
it's hard,
that's smart.
Really,
yeah,
really hard.
Uh-huh.
Ideally, you just would forego the interview completely. So
throw out the CV.
That's a hard sell. I know, it's a hard sell. It's a really hard sell. But, you know, the interview really is the home of bias, because now I am kind of seeing you. I see your demographic characteristics. I see the colors that you wear, and you might happen to wear my favorite color or not. And we know all of those irrelevant things, which should be irrelevant, in fact, do matter in our evaluations. So my best advice is to forego the interview completely and move to work sample tests.
Okay.
But that's a hard sell.
Mm-hmm.
Most people will still want to do an interview. So then the question is, how do you do the interview?
Right.
And there are a number of recommendations that are pretty well substantiated by the research. The first one is, many organizations do panel interviews where they have three individuals, let's say,
mm-hmm,
interview just one person,
mm-hmm,
thinking that this would be really great. We have three different people.
Yeah, they'll be looking for different things.
Exactly.
And they'll see different things.
But of course, they actually won't, because let's assume, you know, you and I and the third person will be the interviewers. I, of course, hear the kinds of questions that you ask, and I also hear the candidate's responses to your questions. And that will already influence my own assessment. So you could be a lenient interviewer, or you could be a tough interviewer. You could ask questions which, in theory, I think are irrelevant, but now that I've heard you kind of ask the question about the person's, you know, conscientiousness or something,
mm-hmm,
I can't just disregard that. So we often call this groupthink,
okay,
in that the group, in fact, is not better than kind of, it's basically a sample size of one, right? Because this group came up with one assessment of the candidate. And that's fine if we believe that this is a sample size of one, that we have now a group assessment of the one person. But my recommendation normally is to say, if we have three interviewers, for example, on the panel, it'd be much better if the three people ran this interview separately. And so that doesn't mean more time for the interviewer. Every person just spends half an hour kind of talking to the job candidate. It's more time consuming for the candidate because the candidate now has to spend, you know, 1.5 hours, mm-hmm. half hour with each interviewer. Mm-hmm. But at least these three interviewers would now come up with different assessments of the candidate. So that would be my first recommendation.
Free of sort of influence of other people's questions. Okay.
Exactly. Then my second recommendation is to do a structured interview where we determine the questions beforehand. Mm-hmm. And that's actually now, thankfully, becoming much more common than about 10 or 20 years ago even, in that people have realized that we often go into tangents when we talk to different people, that we might talk about a hobby with somebody or their favorite music with somebody else mm-hmm. or their kids or their previous vacation. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, some people might share the same hobby that I have. Mm-hmm. And I just like them because of that hobby, but that's not necessarily predictive of their future performance in my organization. So the problem with unstructured interview is not that there's nothing useful happening, but the challenge is that there's a lot of noise mm-hmm. that is hard for my mind kind of to tease apart the two.
Mm-hmm. But isn't it human nature as well, and you're a behavioral scientist, that you want to work with, you know, someone once gave me the advice that, you know, people work well or you get promoted because people like you, not necessarily based on your skills. Like, there's a likability factor. And I think you also, let's explore that. I mean, is that not important? Again, just being aware that we are flawed human beings with mindsets that are unlikely to be changed.
Yeah.
I mean, part of that interaction, so when you're connecting with someone in a conversation, it's giving you a sense of how will we vibe together when we work together. I mean, it's...
Yeah.
What's yours? What would you say
Absolutely.
About that?
Absolutely. Very, very human, but again, home of bias. So we do know that we tend to like people who look like we do.
Yeah.
We often call this affinity bias. Mm-hmm. That can be in terms of gender, can be in terms of skin color, mm-hmm. can be in terms of nationality, sexual orientation,
yeah,
you know, lots of things, even accent. So that's, I think, the challenge. Now, I'm completely agreeing with you. It's very human mm-hmm. That we have this, what we sometimes call in-group bias, mm-hmm. that we feel more comfortable with people kind of who, you know, who share the same kinds of jokes and the same kinds of hobbies, as I said before. But, you know, a functioning organization and even a functioning team in fact, flourishes from diversity, from different backgrounds, and kind of comfort and fit and ease of understanding, in fact, are not good predictors of future team performance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not saying it's not easier to work in a team where everyone mm-hmm. runs into the same direction naturally, mm-hmm. but then we fall prey to in-group bias and mm-hmm. then groupthink again, mm-hmm. where we don't challenge each other mm-hmm. enough. Mm-hmm. So it's a real mm-hmm. problem that we want to like the person we mm-hmm. work with. And so for people who insist that likability is really important and they spend so much time with their, you know, executive assistant or whatever it mm-hmm. might be, mm-hmm. that they need to have somebody who kind of shares some of the same humor, etc., mm-hmm. then I would say, A, be aware that this is very likely going to be biased, that you're very likely going to go for people who look like you. And we can show that. I mean, the research suggests that, you know, we even look for people who graduated from the same college that we did. So this is real. But secondly, if likability is so important, at least make it explicit. So if you have, let's say, 5 questions in your structured interview, make this question number 6, so to speak, or characteristic number 6. And you then give the person a rating from 1 to 10.
Okay.
And it's literally called likability.
Okay.
Right. So now at least I make what is invisible and we know is affecting many people, we make it visible. And now I can have, you know, a more explicit conversation with you, for example, who might have interviewed the person as well. And you can, you know, push me a little bit and say, are you really willing to forego this person's excellence in these other 5 questions that you've asked her just because you like her?
Have you actually ever had a real life sort of situation where they did put likability? Because it's an interesting idea.
So I myself haven't. In fact, uh-huh. I did not. So I hired my assistant exactly the way I just described to you.
Okay.
So
a research assistant
we
or
did,
executive?
My executive assistant, my executive coordinator. Uh-huh. And we, in fact, used a three-step process. So we first blinded ourselves to demographic characteristics. We looked at CV, but we blinded ourselves to demographic characteristics. So we didn't know gender, race, any other identifiers. We also blinded ourselves to the school the person had attended.
Okay.
We rated every CV from a scale from 1 to 10, and then we put the CV in the drawer. And then secondly, we had everyone do a work sample test. In fact, I spent some time thinking about what I look for in an executive coordinator, what are kind of important skills, tasks, competencies that a person has to have. So, for example, I designed a itinerary travel planning kind of problem where...
Because that's a big part of what the job would
that
entail.
That is a big part of the job. But, we had a number of things. This wasn't the only task, but just to give a concrete example. And then it literally said, she has to go to New York, speak at the UN, then she travels to London and has to do that, and then to Zurich, etc. And of course, people couldn't know everything. They couldn't know travel schedules, etc., flight schedules. But we wanted to know who asks the important questions. You know, which presentation is she going to give? Is it going to be a PowerPoint? Is there going to be an interview involved? Who is she going to meet? What does she need to know about these people? Etc., etc. And then we rated all these answers of all candidates from a scale from 1 to 10 again and put them in a drawer. But again, you know, we didn't know who gave which answer. So these people just had a code number. So this was number 1, number 2, number 3. And then finally, thirdly, I did interview everyone face to face. And that was, of course, a little funny because I had to tell the people that I don't know who you are. I don't know what CV you have, and I don't know how you did on the test. But this is now, but we're trying to do this based on research evidence out there and how to really evaluate people. And I have prepared 5 questions. I'm going to ask everyone the same 5 questions. And I am, start with question 1, and I'm then going to compare those questions. I don't know, by the way, I said most everything I'm telling you now. The last thing I'm now going to tell you, I probably didn't say, but I don't remember. But then I asked the 5 questions. But then in the end, I compared answers to every question, what I want to call horizontally. So I compared every person's answer to question 1 across all candidates.
Okay.
And then I looked at all answers to question 2, et cetera. That's what I call horizontally, to calibrate my thinking. Because another problem is that, when I talk to you, your answer to question 1 might be brilliant, and then I'm already sold, and I don't even pay attention to questions 2, 3, 4, and 5. I call this the halo effect.
You had me at hello.
Right. Well, that's exactly right. Or, you wear my favorite color, so you had me already as you entered the room. So that's the thing. So we try to control for the halo effect. In fact, many faculty members, when they grade exams, they also grade horizontally. And I did that too, meaning, for example, I might have had 3 different questions, essay questions,
right.
And then I would read all answers to question 1 first, again, horizontally, right? And then move on to question 2, and then blind myself to your answers to question 1. So I could give every answer to every question kind of an independent new chance and wouldn't be influenced.
So I have 2 reactions to this. The first is, that sounds like a lot of work. I don't know how important work, but I don't know how many people would want to do that. And then the other question that I had, just as I think about it, particularly for the interview for the person that you were hiring to work with you as an executive assistant, was you started off, when you did the bland evaluation, looked at the CVs and ranked them, what you were saying is that everybody that got to see you could do the job. And now, is that where you got to? So by the time you met the people in person, you'd establish that they can do the job. So in meeting them face to face, remind me, were you now testing ability? What, or was that an integral part of being able to do the job? I don't know if my question makes sense.
I mean, I don't think anyone knows, it's really a million-dollar question. Whenever I teach on this, people ask me, so what are the predictive questions? What are the right questions? Honestly, we don't know. We don't know. Of course, most providers will tell you that they have figured out the secret sauce and the right questions. Most don't evaluate. Most companies don't do these longitudinal studies where they then look at the questions asked and how well, whatever the ranking or the rating of the question was, the answer to the question was, how well that actually predicts future performance. There are companies like Google. They do exactly that. And then they change questions. So they have these structured interviews, and then they realize number seven is just not correlated with future performance. So then they replace number seven. But it's a little bit of trial and error process, because not every question is equally as predictive of every job, right? Mm-hmm. You might imagine that conscientiousness is probably pretty important for many jobs. Mm-hmm. But some other communication skills, some other skills might be mm-hmm. more relevant for some jobs and not for other jobs. So mm-hmm. so you have to experiment with that a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I have to answer your first question, because that's an important one. You know, it does sound complicated, and it was, because we did everything from hand, because I really mm-hmm. wanted to experience what this looks like. Mm-hmm. But it turns out we now have these providers which okay. do all of this for you. It is just, and it doesn't actually take longer. It often is, requires less time to evaluate somebody, because you don't do the CV at all. You move to work samples right away, and then then the machine does the comparative evaluation for you.
Okay.
I wouldn't worry about the time. Okay. It's just a different technique. And a different software that you need.
And so the person you hired, are they working out?
Yeah, they're great. They are great.
They're still here.
Yes. Yeah. They're great. Okay. They're here. They're wonderful. Yes.
Okay. So let's keep going this whole sort of process of hiring. Now you've got the job. I'll stick with the idea of a woman. I'm thinking about women in leadership. Part of what happens once you have the job, a year in, a year and a half in, there's the evaluations, there's promotions, you want to go up the ladder. What's happening now?
So I'll answer that question in just a moment, but I have to tell you one more thing about hiring that we haven't touched upon, that I actually feel very strongly about. And that is that we should try to hire more in bundles.
In bundles,
okay. Yes.
What do you mean by that?
In fact, let me maybe give you another, just deviate for a second and give you another illustration, and then kind of come back to the hiring context. So about 1.5 years ago, I was in Stockholm meeting with the Nobel Prize Foundation.
Okay.
And they had invited me because...
Obvious question, they give out the Nobel Prize.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so they had realized that 97% of all Nobel Prizes in the sciences had gone to men.
Okay.
And so they were just trying to understand more about kind of what the process that they're using, what they could be different. I have to reframe that. So they wanted to learn more about the procedures they were using, and whether there might be something that they could improve there. And, of course, much of this is secret and should remain secret. But one thing that was written about afterwards that I can't talk about now, and that I also suggested without knowing anything about the procedure, is the following. So every year I get a form from the Nobel Foundation inviting me to nominate somebody for the Nobel Prize in economics. I'm an economist by training.
Mm-hmm.
And that form asks me to nominate one person, and one person only.
Okay.
And so I told them that would be the first thing I would change. In fact, I suggested to them to ask nominators like myself to make 3 recommendations, not just one.
Okay.
And now here's why. So a few years ago, people did research, psychologists did research on food choices. And they were trying to understand the variety of foods that people consume. And let me give you a way to think about this. So imagine you would go into a high school, let's say, and you were trying to understand what snacks these students consume. Then you would ask half of the high school students to choose a snack for every day of the month for the next month. So today you're making 30 choices. You have endless snacks available, but today you have to make 30 commitments, so to speak, what to have for the next month.
Yeah.
And then the other half of the high school, you would ask to choose a snack every morning of every day of the month. So they also choose 30 snacks, but sequentially.
Okay.
So the first group is kind of a simultaneous choice, or think of this as the bundle choice. Now mm-hmm. I make kind of this whole kind of cluster of choices, and then the second group does this sequentially.
Okay.
And lots of studies have been conducted, kind of similar to the one that I just described to you, finding that people who choose simultaneously, who choose many snacks at the same time, are much more likely to go for variety than people who choose sequentially.
Okay.
Right? And that often
that's almost intuitive, isn't it?
Right, I mean,
you want to make sure you have variety over the 30 days
exactly.
and not eating
you
the same
imagine,
thing over
right?
and
even
over.
Though you have a favorite snack,
that's
you wouldn't
right.
imagine you want to eat it 30 times in a row. I sometimes also talk about our favorite lunch restaurant, right? We go to some restaurant and we always have a Caesar salad with crab meat. But every time, and that's my own personal example, which is also true, every time I think I'm going to have something different today. you can't always have the Caesar salad with crab meat, and every time I almost have the Caesar salad with crab meat. But if you ask me today, I probably wouldn't commit for the rest of my life to just have Caesar salad and crab meat. So anyway, so we applied that, I mean, and a few other people from Wharton as well, applied that to people choices. And we're finding the very same pattern, that diversity is much more likely to emerge when you choose a bundle of people at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that has a number of reasons. I mean, the psychology is kind of interesting. One is that, think of this more as a portfolio now, mm-hmm. that if you, you know, buy stocks and you buy more than one, you try to diversify, right? And now you hire five people, you're trying to diversify. Okay. You're thinking more about collective intelligence rather than just individual intelligence. Now you think about complementarities between the different people, et cetera.
It forces you to do a little bit of thinking about what your decision is.
As a team, as a group, right? Yeah. And not just even, it forces you, but also enables you to have that kind of thinking, because otherwise if you do it sequentially, it doesn't come naturally to you. The other advantage is based on some of my own research where we're showing that if you do these comparative assessments, if you evaluate people kind of comparatively next to each other, you're much less likely to rely on stereotypes. And that also has kind of a psychological foundation in that a big insight of behavioral decision research, which is kind of some of my background, is that it's very hard for people to make absolute judgments. So whether or not you think it's cold in here, whether or not you like the water in front of you, has something to do with the temperatures you're used to, something to do with the drinks you're having. And if I don't give you a comparator, your mind is smart enough to find one. Mm-hmm. And then your mind is going to look at what do the people who kind of have made it in my organization, who kind of are in those positions, what do they look like? And that's kind of my reference point. And then I compare the candidate with that reference point. So by giving you various people, I help you make those calibrations with real people. And we're showing that evaluators make assessments much more on the competencies of these people rather than on stereotypes.
And so the Nobel Foundation took that recommendation.
My initiating story. So yes, so now the new form that I get asks me to make three recommendations, not just one. So I'm going to repeat that. So the new form that I'm getting now asks me to make three recommendations, not just one. And of course, that's not research. It's just a story. But last year was the first year where we had two women win the Nobel Prizes in chemistry and physics simultaneously ever. So anyway, so these are the kinds of design choices super simple, are basically costless, but just are a bit smarter design.
Okay. Well, we're almost running out of time, but I want to finish the sort of the whole cycle. So I want to be in the workplace.
We have to talk about career advancement.
We have to. Yes, absolutely. You know, so how do you, what happens when a woman's getting promoted? I mean, the number of times I've had conversations with other women about, oh my God, it's so difficult. I'm not being recognized. What am I doing wrong? Well, what's happening?
Yeah. So super, super important. In fact, we, of course, see much more diversity at the entry level than at the top. So this whole question of career advancement is very, very relevant. And it's also where most of my research now is. Okay. And I typically think about kind of three potential biases that we should be paying attention to. I mean, there's more than three, but the three that I think are particularly prevalent. And the first one, I actually came across almost by happenstance in that I worked with a law firm, and the law firm had called me in because they had already done some data analysis and had observed that they had a gender and a race gap and also a U.S. versus non-U.S. employees gap in terms of promotions to partners. And so we saw that, so they knew that, and they wanted to fix that. So we looked at the process, and we did a few things about the process, but they also kept telling me about something that they called the problem of the thin file. And what they meant with the thin file was that some people literally, when they came up for evaluation for promotion to partner in year 8, they had little material kind of to submit. I mean, literally a thin file. Mm-hmm. And we could show that the thin file problem really started in year 1 when some attorneys, some first-year associates, were given more opportunities to perform in this company. And we could show that it's not just that these partners, who are primarily, of course, men, primarily white, primarily Americans, that they replicate those demographic characteristics, but they even chose first-year associates who had graduated from the same law school as they did. So a lot of in-group bias going on because partners at that point, you know, choose people they want to work with and then people they mentor, nurture, etc.
I think it's a short thing. If I get this person, I know what the result would be because it's a shortcut.
And it's unconscious again.
Unconscious
bias. Okay. It's not conscious as in purposely trying to exclude certain people. But Emilio Castilla of MIT, in fact, at the Sloan School, called this performance support bias, in that some people aren't given the support to perform. So that's the first thing every employer should pay attention to. That, of course, promotion doesn't start the night before the promotion. Right? It starts much earlier when some of us are included in the cool deals, some of us are given more feedback, are given more stretch assignments, can go to the leadership training, and others can't. The law firm, in fact, what they're doing is they have centralized work allocation now, that a centralized partner in the little office, they now allocate these first-year associates to partners. And then they watch also over time whether some people are more likely to be paired with the star attorneys and others really don't get an opportunity. So that's the first thing, performance support bias.
I can almost say another nugget from there is that you could advise women to also ask for more opportunities, to sort of demand the sort of support, more opportunities for stretch assignments, more, I mean, that is something that you could also demand, I guess. I mean, that could be part of it.
I'm giving you a tentative yes here, in the sense that, yes, and certainly Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In is all about kind of women can just being a slightly more courageous, a bit more risk-taking, a bit more demanding of those opportunities. Now, research by Hannah Riley Bowles here at the Kennedy School, my co-director of the Women in Public Policy program, shows that, unfortunately, there can be backlash for such counter-stereotypical behaviors. So what she means with that is that, you know, you're now running into the Heidi problem.
The Heidi problem.
Where you don't conform to my image, to my stereotype of what a good woman does, of how a good woman behaves, right? She is nice and agreeable.
And she's not demanding things.
So it's a, you know, so it's tricky. So I don't want to leave us thinking it's not possible at all. But I think women have to engage in counter-stereotypical actions kind of with their eyes wide open. But maybe let me give you kind of two more thoughts quickly. I know we're close to running out of time, but I do want to leave you with two more quick thoughts. The first one is actually ongoing research right now where we're looking at performance appraisals. Prevalent in most organizations, surveys suggest that about 95% of all employers have them in some sort. And in practice that many, many employers use is to ask their employees to self-evaluate.
Right.
And then share those self-evaluations with their managers before managers make up their minds.
Okay.
Now, it turns out
that I've done that before.
It doesn't require, you know, rocket science to imagine that, of course, somebody's self-evaluation now is going to impact the manager's assessment. And if people differ in their willingness to shine the light on themselves, or even in the cultural appropriateness of shine the light on yourself.
Yeah, boasting.
Right.
Yeah.
Some of us,
and think
of the Heidi problem again.
Yeah.
Some of us will be less likely to rate ourselves very highly because we fear backlash or because it's just not culturally appropriate. Yeah. So we found both cross-cultural differences, but also gender differences. And now we lucked out in that we found a company that had exactly this practice, but then in 1 year wasn't able to share self-evaluations with managers before managers made up their mind. So we now can show and really measure what difference does it make. And it turns out that, of course, the difference is most pronounced for newcomers, for people who did not have a history in this company, where the managers, you know, couldn't remember what we have done in previous years, but in fact just knew. And we're seeing quite different evaluations when these managers aren't anchored on people's self-evaluation. So what we found was that, you know, what you might have expected, that men tend to evaluate themselves more highly than women. We also found that whites tend to evaluate themselves more highly than people of color. And then when we don't share those self-evaluations with managers for these newcomers in that given year, what we see is either the gap is closed or for gender even reversed. So sharing self-evaluations is just not a smart practice. I don't know of any evidence suggesting that this is actually a good thing. And so here my recommendation would be in order to overcome evaluation bias, not to share self-evaluations.
Okay, but performance evaluations in general are okay?
That's a very good question. they're absolutely controversial. I don't think I have enough research to say whether they're, you know, overall good or bad. My fear, I just want to be very transparent of why I'm reluctant here. My fear is that companies which have done away with them now might rely even more on their instinct, on their gut in evaluating people. And we know that's the home of bias. Generally, I would always argue to rely on as measurable, as objective criteria for evaluations as possible.
We've got 30 seconds left. What would you want to sort of end this on? Do you want to summarize the sort of big ideas, or is there a particular line of thought that you might just want to leave our listeners thinking about?
Yeah. So maybe, you know, my biggest piece of advice in many ways is kind of twofold. First of all, measure. Most organizations just don't measure. And what we know, that what doesn't get measured doesn't count. And also what doesn't get measured cannot be fixed. So measurement is really important. Then my second piece of advice is move beyond trying to fix people and fix your systems. You can de-bias your systems, whether that's in hiring or promotion, in performance appraisals, or even in team meetings. Try to think hard about the procedures and practices that you use to create an equal playing field for everyone.
So you're going to have to come back again because there's so much there.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much. This was wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening. Please join us for our next episode, when our guest will be Professor David Deming, who says the prospect of free college in the U.S. may be closer to reality than many of us think.